You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org. Hi, everyone. Lovely to see you this evening. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming here at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And I'm happy you're all here for this program. And we are doing this along with Skylight Books, so that's who you see in our lobby. So please buy the book after, and there is a reception. I'm going to say this a number of times, so you join us for cheese and wine. But before we begin this tonight's program, in the spirit of reconciliation, the Los Angeles Public Library and Skylight recognize and acknowledge the First Peoples of this land. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Indigenous peoples today. I have to do this every time, so forgive me. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private, nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in support of the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you to any member and supporter in the audience this evening. And if you are not yet a member or supporter, I hope you will consider supporting the Library Foundation and continue to see programs like this one and to help increase critical access to information, resources, and technology to help Angelenos improve their lives across this vast city. You can support through joining by scanning right over here, the QR code on the screen. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Estate of Suzanne E. Aron, Errant Fox Schiff, the Hearst Foundation, Golden Globe Foundation, and the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, and, of course, individual donors and members. And before I go any further, I want to also thank Michael at Skylight and his staff, who also made this evening possible, and thank them for everything. We are now wrapping up our season, our fall season of Aloud. Our next program and our last program is next Thursday, and we are in partnership with the LA Phil. We'll be featuring one of this year's finalists for the National Book Award, the renowned Mexican writer Cristina Rivera Garza. This program promises to be interesting. There's it's coupled with a, you can buy half price tickets, I think, by showing that you've gone to the lecture before or her conversation. Choreographer has taken the book and put parts of it to dance. So to learn more about this program, please visit lfla.org/aloud. And now, for this evening's program, I'm very pleased to introduce two wonderful guests, the two-time Poet Laureate of the United States, Tracy K. Smith, and writer Morgan Parker. I realized that I've introduced Tracy K. Smith throughout my career in programming, first at the Strand Bookstore in 2011, with her Pulitzer Prize-winning Book of Poems, Life on Mars. And then 4 years later, I interviewed her at the New York Public Library about her memoir, Ordinary Light. I've watched from afar as her career as a poet, writer, essayist has grown, admiring her grace and thoughtful trajectory, always being astounded by the undeniable rhythm and exacting beauty of her use of language. And this important, thoughtful book of interlinked essays, To Free the Captives, is yet another piece in her astounding career. As the Washington Post put it so perfectly in a recent review of Free the Captives, quote, Smith, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and professor of English and African American studies at Harvard, writes prose at once dazzling and exacting. On nearly every page of this book is a phrase or sentence to marvel over, a word, usually an adjective, so unexpectedly apt that it freshens familiar language. When Smith's father leaves his Alabama hometown for Detroit in 1953, there is, quote, something in him that bucks with haphazard hope. During the pandemic, Smith is awed by, quote, the undeterred industry of birds, foxes, and squirrels in her yard. And when her twin sons are born, she watches, quote, legs pedaling against the sudden air.
Sudden is shocking, but richly and irreplaceably right. To free the captives is so luscious that it often reads less like a collection of essays than like a work of prose poetry. Its six long sections and brief coda are not neatly contained narratives or discrete arguments, but threads in one continuous web of reminiscence and observation. Tracy K. Smith is a librettist, a translator, and the author of five acclaimed poetry collections, including Life on Mars, which was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. Her memoir, Ordinary Light, was a finalist for the National Book Award. From 2017 to 2019, she served as the 22nd Poet Laureate of the United States. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with Morgan Parker, who is a poet, essayist, and novelist. She is the author of the young adult novel, Who Put This Song On?, and the poetry collections, Other People's Comfort Keeps Me Up at Night, There Are More Beautiful Things Than Beyonce, and Magical Negro, which won the 2019 National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. She is a recipient of the National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship, winner of the Pushcart Prize, and a Cave Canon Graduate Fellow. Please welcome Tracy K. Smith and Morgan Parker. Thank you.
Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Excellent. Thank you, Tracy, for being here. Are you going to start with the reading?
Yeah, I'll start with the reading. And thank you. This is an excerpt from a chapter called One More Sunny Day. And one of the strands that it weaves in is a meditation practice that I entered into in 2020. And I'll read you just a few pages that also take us to a plantation in coastal Georgia where a collaborator and I were doing research for an opera. It is August 2020, a late summer morning deep in a difficult year, and I am all but overcome. Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? In meditation, I sit, I breathe, I wait. I pass through all the stages of self-consciousness and disbelief, by now so familiar as to assure me I am in the midst of a practiced rite. And then, with patience, a voice arrives to address me. We are born again and again into every age. We live, we die, we return. This is our purpose. Oh, but the litany of names, our beautiful black names. The names of the freed have become a never-ending dirge, ever lengthening and always close to mind. I cannot bear to repeat it. I will not accept that our purpose is merely to live, to die. I cannot leave it at that, as if we are simply the raw material of a system with no volition of its own, a machine that, once set to run, must complete its course. There is too much working too hard to convince me that my fate as a black person in America is to be consumed. There are too many waiting too eagerly for me to accept this as fact. I push back. Why does it hurt so much? Why does the world hate us so much? Something tender, an audible smile, softens the reply that follows. Just imagine how God feels. I am hearing a woman's voice, a mother's voice. My mind lights up with the joy of claiming kin. Oh, sweetie, she is telling me, not with words, but with tone. This is not some pat thing we are talking about. This is life. It is huge. It is heavy. It is hard for everyone involved. Not even God is let off easily. She leans so far from her previous remove as to become visible in my mind's eye, not as a figure, not as a silhouette, not even as a form so much as a presence, something pulsing and alive, pale pink and bathed in a liquid white light, like an organ, yes, as if we are all birthed through this force, this source. What I hear next, what I allow myself to receive, is this. The purpose of our work, the purpose of living itself, is not to be embraced, not even to prevail, but to continue spreading love in whatever way we can, planting something the earth needs, seeding the planet so it might proceed. Throughout my life, I've heard the spiritual sung in church and played on record certain Sunday afternoons in the family room in Fairfield, California. I've heard my parents croon and hum and reference them, felt in my chest the swell of recognition when they reach me in the world as if of their own determination. I've accepted them, and likewise the gospel promises of soon and by and by as balm in heavy times. But I have not ever felt them as close to what must be their original source as I do when I witness them in the ring shout for the first time, enacted by a troop of practitioners in the American South. I'm traveling in coastal Georgia and South Carolina to conduct research for an opera libretto I've been commissioned to write. Though beyond the nouns, Black people, land, and history, I am hard-pressed to describe what the work will be about. I am traveling with a composer, several members of the opera's administrative staff, a historian, and two musicologists. Ours is a fact-finding trip. For me, it is also a feeling-finding trip. I am seeking to bump up against the discomfort and unrest, the credible conflict that will lead me to discover the story I have agreed to tell. I do not have to look far. Perhaps because my collaborator and I have signaled a good many times that our story centers upon Black people, land, and history, or for other reasons altogether, we find ourselves as lodgers at what is described as the oldest plantation in Georgia, remaining with its original family. The original house is small, colonial. There are cats inside, lolling around amid books and dolls and furniture objects that intimate, or are they attempting to perform, the presence of history? But we are sleeping and eating and being greeted in a newer, ample, many-roomed structure that resembles a converted barn. This fact is, for me, a source of minor but perceptible relief. One of the first things we are told is that our hosts, a mother and daughter who are descendants of this property's original family, have set aside thousands of acres of their inherited land for conservation. I don't know whether the slave dwellings have been preserved, whether they are still standing farther away, or if they have fallen or been razed. But save for the oyster mounds and shell circles that bear witness to complex indigenous societies predating the arrival of British subjects by thousands of years. Welcome are the non-native species, invasive, some have been deemed, refugees of an ever-dwindling global habitat. Surveying the tall marsh grasses and the moss-laden trees, a part of me agrees a golf course or a gated neighborhood tract here would be a diminishment. There is a plausible heroism to holding such things at bay. Perhaps in the context of our visit, there is little point in broaching the various varieties of violence and the inevitable forms of theft, making it possible for this family to maintain enduring autonomy over this land. Maybe it is correct that I hold my tongue when our host opens her arms to the morning sun, sifted through the boughs of a live oak, and asks no one in particular, "What did we do to deserve this?" I tell myself I am here to listen, to gather, to glean. In my head, I steam, fume, roll my eyes. But for the most part, I save my talking for a later time. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. I love that part. I'm so interested in, so I was just saying, I went to a plantation, one only, and wrote about it, an essay. But the difference was that I was the only person on my plantation to were. It was strange. So I'm really curious about the other folks that you were traveling with and the kind of, I guess, potential alienation you felt from them, or like what were the different responses to the same environment.
It's really interesting what happens when you step into history of this kind. My collaborator is a composer named Greg Spears, and we were both really trying to think about weight, silence, presence, things that have been at least attempted to be erased. And so I feel like we would have these conversations, we'd pull each other aside and just say, okay, let's just talk about this. But lots of things were happening. One member of our group, on a visit to a local history museum, saw a picture of one of her ancestors in a portrait and learned that this person had been a slaveholder. And so she went through a kind of cathartic, that whole thing of shock. And I think it's a complicated thing because there's also a form of recognition. Mm-hmm. And so that was also really interesting to witness.
Absolutely.
The musicologists who were with us were bringing a lot of artifacts into dialogue with practice that still exists. And so there was a side of this conversation that really felt beautiful to say, they were here, we were them, and we/they are still here, and there's a living presence that transmits so much and that balances so much. It's a weird place. I was also quite in my head. My parents were Southerners, but I grew up on the West Coast and have spent most of my adult life on the East Coast. And so there are these fears that I become subject to when I'm in the South. And I'm thinking, what will be said? Mm-hmm. And on that trip in particular, a lot was said.
Right.
that just reminded me of how much we haven't yet unraveled, how much we haven't brought into common space and talked about. So part of the impulse to write, of course, is to try and do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, how much do we have to pull someone aside to talk about, right? And how many times do we have to hold our tongue? Selfishly, I want to talk a lot about process. I would love to just hear about the process of making this book. Couple sub questions. When you were working on the opera, did you think that, I'm also going to explore this experience in an essay? I guess how much of your life were you consciously raising for the project? And I guess how long did it take? And yeah.
There's a lot of writing in this book that I didn't think was going to be for a project like this, but that became helpful. I don't know that I imagined I would write an essay about the plantation. I don't know if you felt this way, but I just wanted to be done with the experience. And there's a scene at the same place toward the end of our stay where the daughter of that original family was clearing breakfast plates, and my fork fell, and I put it back on the plate, and she said, stop trying to help me.
Right.
And I just, the wound of that, yeah. And yes, the hilarity of that, mm-hmm. It landed in the part of my brain that is a writer, but I often was like, oh, I just don't want to unpack it.
Yeah.
Even, you know, this essay or this chapter even says, why am I so wanting to be rid of this? Mm-hmm. Why am I jotting this down as though I can just, you know, let it go and move on from it? But I did know that there were things that had to do with the ring shout ritual that this chapter in part takes up that I really wanted to come mm-hmm. back to. And it emerged for me as a practice that made me feel like ritual is what we need, collective ritual is what we need as a nation. Mm. And so in 2020, when I was trying to think about, you know, what are alternatives to just trusting our institutions to fix us, ritual became one vocabulary that seemed useful, and I knew I wanted to come back to the ring shout. Because it's something, you know, yes, there's this feeling we have to have conversations about this, and maybe those of us who come from the aggrieved parties feel like we have a lot to teach. But being in the space of this living tradition made me really humble mm-hmm. because I realized that there are dimensions of practice and resistance that are much larger than my vocabulary for what that conversation should sound like. Mm-hmm. And so that was really helpful to think about. This book was a really hard one for me to settle into to write. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of archival searching that actually began as sort of procrastination.
Interesting. We love research. You know, I love to just be like, I don't know, researching.
Yeah, let's see what we can exactly. learn a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And it brings me back to that sense of ritual because it was finding my father's family's, you know, the evidence of their lives in the artifact, finding even among some papers that I had inherited chapters from my father's life that I didn't know about. It really deepened that sense of dialogue with the ancestors that I had believed my meditative practice to have opened up. Mm. And so in a lot of ways, writing this book felt like a collaboration with them, listening for whims that would lead me in really fruitful directions. And that actually was a kind of healing in a way. Wow. To imagine that the hard work that we know we are here to do mm-hmm. is something that we're not doing alone in the dark, that these other presences, let's say, maybe you're not as comfortable as I am in saying, you know, people speaking to you from the spirit dimension or from beyond the material realm, maybe you just want to think a bit about it as the clues and the tools that they've left that we've inherited in different ways through lore, through evidence in the archive, through practice, and through these voices that don't really go away. Mm-hmm. All of those things feel like they're capable of working with us and guiding the work. And so this book, in some ways, became really exhilarating and joyful to write because that presence became more and more amplified. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's incredible. I feel that I have felt that in right, like I felt that in Magical Negro that I was like, who wrote that? Boom. But it was terrifying to me, you know? So I'm interested in that being, and maybe it has to do with your active engagement in the archives at the same time or creating this meditative space where it was more invited. But I'm interested in that, the fact that that was not something feared in the writing process, but like moved toward.
Yeah, I just have felt for so many of these recent, you know, unusual feeling years, logic isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
The logic that we've been obedient to our whole lives doesn't yield clarity. Mm-hmm. It doesn't lead us to fair outcomes, mm-hmm. and that's what was really scary to me.
Yeah.
And so to step into this other view of consciousness and existence, which felt viable,
mm-hmm.
wasn't scary at all.
Yeah.
It felt like the kind of scale shift that makes literature
right.
illuminating.
More transcendent than anything else. And yeah, there was something that you said, realm spanning. I loved just that phrase in terms of how we, as a community of, you know, dead and alive and not yet alive, kind of interact with each other, I guess. I love that idea. I wrote it under this, and also this is just like, this is not even a question we could talk about for 45 minutes. It just says soul versus body. So we can go on forever. But you talk a lot about the soul in a way that is so refreshing to me as like a former Christian school kid. That's like, I'm just thinking about my soul like burning all the time. Like that's assuredly what's happening with my soul. There's no other option for my soul. And I love, you know, and while part of my brain is always like soul food and soul music, there is just like this negative connotation to the soul that's like this something to dread, you know, mm-hmm. this interaction with the soul.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love, I love the way that you speak about it outside of its kind of like Christian Baptist connotations.
Mm-hmm.
And also what drove you to considering the soul specifically? I think a lot about like the mind. I think as poets and just also as Black Americans right now, we're so focused on the body and embodiment. Yeah, so what drew you to kind of untangling that idea?
Okay, I'm gonna try and gather these things together. But one urge came from the feeling of constraint that I've often felt as someone whose job is in the academy,
mm-hmm.
in talking about the numinous or the, you know, illogical, or I think of it as rather counter logic of the spirit, even though it's real and present for me,
mm-hmm.
with, you know, complexity and even degrees of, you know, conflict, it's there. And I started to think about why that inhibition exists, and I think it comes down for some of us to the ways that Christianity has been used to justify systems of power and the violence of that, of those systems. And so the vocabulary of the soul and justice or judgment suggest there's accountability
mm-hmm.
somewhere out there.
Right.
And I can imagine why that would be something to laugh off, avoid, mm-hmm. or silence. But then I think, but I don't descend from histories of power. I descend from the people in the ring mm-hmm. doing this spirit work in order to rebuild themselves from a society that's made to all but destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. You know, they built so much for us,
mm-hmm.
even amidst the, you know, demands and pressures of a barbarous institution. And I'm not only talking about slavery, but segregation,
oh, yeah.
all the systems that perpetuate those initial hierarchies. And so I just became almost defiantly invested in mining and lifting up this this belief in the eternal within us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even think it has to be attached to religion.
Right.
I think it, you know, I think many people are comfortable thinking about consciousness in that way.
Exactly.
And so if Black consciousness is a powerful site,
mm-hmm.
It's one that I'm going to turn to when little else seems capable of bolstering. So that's, I think, I don't know if I veered from the question a little bit, but that's one of the big arguments I'm hoping to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the vocabulary that sits around these questions of persistence and might also bring us into a different sense of the accountability we might become more open to in terms
right.
of our fellow citizens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that feels like that might also be one of the miracles we need.
Absolutely. Yeah, that part is very cathartic of like kind of almost like liberating the soul from this systemic religion idea, you know, of, that's all consequences. And thinking about it instead as what are the remnants, you know, like what has been left for us that's like there for us to tap into. And I also think, you know, it's no surprise that Black power came out of Black consciousness movement. You know, that's how power is attained, is just through consciousness. So I think that's just really well done, especially with your threads about meditation and just clarity of mind and perspective shifts. I think that is throughout this. And yeah, I think that's something that we see so wonderfully played out in your individual life, but also suggested for the rest of us. So kind of going back to that idea of your personal archive, at what point in the writing did you discover or did you kind of try to fit together how the book was going to bring your story together with America's soul? You know, at what point were you seeing the multiple messages, I guess? And what was the process of bringing them together, choosing what parts of yourself to include and what parts of your family's story to include or not? And how did that pointing go?
When I write a poem, I just know the questions mm-hmm. that I'm beginning from or the sense of unrest, and I have to listen in language and see what has been clarified in order to know where I'm going. And this is kind of how this book got written as well. Mm-hmm. I started with these, you know, this foray into the archive, and so I learned a lot about my father's side of our family, his grandfather and father and their experience in World War I, his older brother's experience of World War II. And I inherited a lot of papers that gave me insight into my dad's career in the Air Force. So that gave me a portrait of my family's experience of America through these major markers. And then I started to think, well, they're stewards of history, mm-hmm. quietly so, but indelibly so as well. That must mean we all are. Mm. And when I started to really get into what for me felt like discovery about, you know, the terms of freedom we live with, in this country, I believe it means that some are perceived to be free and to have always been free, to descend from a history of power and dominion because they are free, which is a myth. It's actually a history of acts and pacts and theft and, you know, violences, but to live with that assumption and circulation. Mm-hmm. And the rest of us who are not free but rather freed are those who are perceived to descend from histories of subjugation or violence or having been acted upon by those very free. And I said, okay, if I'm finding my family's ability to corroborate that, what about me? Mm-hmm. What in my life can corroborate these hierarchies and not only the ways that they play themselves out, maybe systemically, but also the ways that they have taught us to see ourselves and to behave toward others? And so I said, maybe I have to look at my own life mm-hmm. honestly. And so my first marriage, which spanned a border, I was married to someone from Mexico for several years. I had to look at that dynamic and say, we leveraged power in that relationship in ways that sort of sort of validates this notion of the free and the freed, mm-hmm. or at the very least, some can be more free than others. And so race was something that allowed my then husband to say, well, I may be discriminated against because of my national origin and my language, but I'm not black.
Right.
You know, right. And for me, I think there was this sense of, well, there's a citizenship and there's a guarantee of earning power, mm-hmm. that gave me a sense of power in that relationship. I don't think that we were wielding those things maliciously, but they mm-hmm. were at work.
Yeah.
And so it felt important to say, I'm guilty.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, because we all need to be willing to say that, mm-hmm. I think, in different spaces. So that felt useful. And then it started to feel like really wonderful to say, okay, I think accountability is something I want to come back to. Mm. And my own experience of becoming sober helped me to think that if I could write about that, it might be useful to this notion of nationhood as well. Mm-hmm. And so sobriety, by telling the story of my own sobriety, I also develop an ability, I think, to say, I think we need civic sobriety.
Yeah.
And so it felt illuminating for me at each step. And so I trusted that some of these discoveries and risks might also bring a reader into a feeling of encounter.
Right. There is encouragement for the reader to join you in that searching and also that kind of like self-reflection. I'm not a good meditator, but I was like, maybe I can do it, you know? And I do think that there is something really profound about the way that you call for quiet. I think, yeah, that's something that we just struggle with. And the idea of accountability, I think, just comes right along with it. Like, there is a moment, you speak about the woman who had to see a picture of her ancestor and the kind of, like, forced acknowledgement that entails. I guess I'm just thinking of how can we almost force ourselves into those boxes, into those moments of trying to make sense of it and having to look yourself in the face, I guess.
There's so much, and I think it's strategic, that keeps us busy and spinning wheels or performing mm-hmm. A kind of virtue that is actually tractionless. And so the quiet and the independence, the willingness to be alone with oneself, I think that's really big.
Yeah.
If it weren't important, if it weren't enlarging, and if it weren't capable of bridging a lot of ostensible divides, I don't think there would be so much in our culture keeping us from it.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. I think, and we often don't think about our own kind of like defenses and vices in that way. It's like, oh, I'm choosing to, you know, like drown myself in this. But really, it's pushed upon us. And in a similar way of all these other systems and freeness as well. I feel like we're running out of time, but I did want to ask about that essay, Sobriety. I remember running into you at Princeton like a really long time ago, and you were in the throes of poet laureate responsibilities, and I was like, how are you handling that? And you were like, I quit drinking. And I was like, that makes a lot of sense. Like, that probably would make it a lot easier. So yeah, just I'm thinking not only of that, I think about that a lot, but not only about that in terms of like give up the shit that weighs you down type thing, but also this idea of I thought connecting it to 2020 and everyone being kind of like trapped in their own fear and all the temptation beyond that, I found that to be like a really effective way to talk about this. But I was curious just to hear you speak about what kind of clarity you would wish for us as Americans and like what kind of sobriety we need.
I'm gonna start with poetry as like a maybe a metaphor. When you're reading a poem, you have to accept that your framework is not the framework. And so you sort of set it down. It's within reach, but you set it down and you listen with a kind of like rapt attention to this stranger's voice. Mm-hmm. And when you follow that voice, you become more firmly grounded in the most profound feelings that are yours. Mm-hmm. You get new terms for them, but they come back to you, and you're affirmed that they mean something because they too have been illuminating or clarifying for this other person. I think that mode of listening out and in is something that I really want us to find opportunities to do. Our political discourse is about doing neither of those things, actually. We receive a lot of really repeatable phrases and descriptions, and we wield them. Mm-hmm. And it allows us to not hear what's coming in, not reflect upon it, not let it land in a place where part of it might ring true. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, we're pushing away a kind of questioning that might alert us to the insufficiency of these packaged things. And, yeah. You know, like Orwell says this much better, like, mm-hmm. the language we live in can corrode and debase thought, and then our thought does, you know, creates a vicious cycle. Silence and language, I think, are important tools. Mm-hmm. What else feels important? I guess one of the things about meditation that's really exciting is that it allows you to say ego is not really as important as we think it is. Mm. And the thing that activates so much fear and defensiveness and this notion that I don't want to have this conversation because I don't want to believe that I'm wrong. I don't want to believe that I descend from people who made bad choices. I don't want to believe that I don't deserve what I have. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of that has to do with the force of the ego and how it convinces us that it needs to be prioritized. Mm-hmm. I kind of want us to strip down a little bit.
Yeah.
I feel like that's... when I was in the laureateship, I would go into places that I know were characterized by different voting patterns. Hmm. And I would bring, let's just say that. I would bring poems by other poets, and we would just listen together. And some stranger would say the most beautiful thing about what he had heard in this poem. In fact, I went into a place that was a rehab facility for people who were mandated by courts, mm-hmm. to go into rehab. And before the event started, one of the staffers from the Library of Congress said, "Are you sure you want to go in here? There's a guy in the third row who's got all these white supremacist tats on his face and neck." And I said, "Well, we're here. Let's test out our theory, right?" And that very person said something really powerfully true and beautiful about a poem. It was a love poem, I think, or a breakup poem. And he said, "I know what this poem is about, but for me right now, it's talking about my relationship with substance."
Wow.
And I think we all kind of just were like, wow, there's something really beautiful that he taught us. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be invited into places where we can sort of just let go.
Right.
Even the snap that I might have felt to righteously defend myself, mm-hmm. my heritage against somebody who's wrong-headed, at least in appearances, or maybe at one time was, or maybe still is, I don't know. Mm-hmm. That wasn't actually useful in that space.
Right.
And I just want to imagine or believe that we can build or actually find many more such opportunities. Mm-hmm. But we're constantly being persuaded that they don't exist and that we can't trust each other, and that what we have and know is so much more important than whatever anybody else might be offering.
Right. than what we can learn. And there seems to be more of, let me find how to justify what I already feel, you know, and less about taking in any new information.
And I think most of that has to do with market demands and the notion that if you can double down on who you've told us that you are, we can continue fulfilling those needs that we've convinced you that you have.
Yeah.
And the market is the only thing that is healthy.
Right, exactly. But you know, it's so hard. One thing that I think a lot about is like, how is anyone supposed to change their mind in this economy? You know, it's really hard to change your mind. If you have to, like, do you have to post when you change your mind? You have to tell everyone, like, just so you guys know, I now have different feelings about this. but it does feel like that, where people are like, here's how I feel, I'll feel that way for the next 40 years. We've discussed it, you know? Which is like a really terrifying way to interact with people, you know? Like, where does the conversation go from there? If it's just like, I put everything in bullet points on my profile, there's no dialogue involved in that.
Yeah.
And I do think it has to do with accountability, you know? Because if you are actively changing your mind, you're actively acknowledging what you think and how you feel and why you feel that way and, you know, what other options might exist, which I think is just really scary for people.
And then it's really helpful. Like, an excerpt of that sobriety chapter was posted on the Washington Post this week. And when I first stopped drinking, a lot of people that I shared that with were like, you're not an alcoholic. Why, you don't need to do this. And then, are you still, okay, you're still not drinking, but you know, it's fine if you did. And then this week, I'm so grateful for that because I think I'm realizing I have a problem. You know, like, so I think we actually, it's a process that takes time to realize that what we feel adamantly about is also what we're often wrong about, you know? So I think we just have to also kind of find ways to be a little bit patient with each other.
Right.
It's hard because the stakes are so big.
Exactly.
You know, like,
exactly.
I don't know how many more years we're going to have, like, water.
Right.
How patient can we be?
Yeah, it's like, we got to get to it right now.
somehow it almost seems like interpersonal time has to be slower or something.
Yeah. I think so, because it's getting to the point where it's too dangerous not to be like that, you know? You have 1 second before someone has open carry, you know? So it's like, we really have to slow that down in order to make any kind of change. How are we doing? Are we okay? Should we take questions? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, cool. Questions? All right, we got two up here.
There's a microphone right there.
Thank you. I really so enjoyed listening to you, both of you. If it's okay, I'd like to ask a question about one of your poems that I read. I've been reading last week, Unrest at Baton Rouge. And I'm really curious if you can, I know it was a while ago that you wrote it, but I'm curious if you could share some of your process from looking at that photograph and then creating that poem where you end up talking about love, but you know, you don't really describe exactly the photograph, but you're getting the essence of it. So I'm just curious about the process that you go through to do that.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that poem. It is written in response to a photo that probably many of you saw by a photojournalist named Jonathan Bachman, and it takes place at a protest in which there's this young black woman in a very gauzy sundress that's kind of blowing back in the wind, and she's got bare arms, and she's just standing in almost like almost like a dance or Lee pose, facing a row of police officers in their like riot gear,
like the shields
and masks and batons. And I was invited to write a poem about that by I think the New York Times. And I know how I feel about the circumstances of that encounter, but that's usually not going to get me into a poem that's going to go somewhere that I haven't premeditated. And so I wanted to just look at that image and see what how it was weighted. So there's the heaviness of all of this protective gear and this row of men barricaded behind something. And then this vulnerable seeming woman, but she had a lot of power in the image. And so I was trying to imagine what accounted for that weight. She wasn't afraid and she didn't seem threatening. And so I was intuiting that there was something large, like love, that maybe was what was anchoring that side of the image. And then all of this other counterweight, which was sort of frantic, scurrying to do something to oppose it. And I was thinking, why would love be something to defend oneself against unless it's dangerous, unless it asks something of us that we might not necessarily be naturally willing to give? And so that thought experiment, which a lot of poems for me begin or move quickly into a place that feels a little bit like a thought experiment, that allowed another kind of thinking to happen. So there are lines in that poem. I don't really memorize my own poems very well, but you know, love's blade sizing up the heart's meat is one image in the poem. Or what if love is a language all know, but few speak, but all or near all know. It sounds better than that in the poem. But just thinking about what's within us, but not always active or permitted. And riffing, you know, on what is seen, on other terms of weight or value or balance, is one way that a poem for me can go forward. And when I begin to feel like that process has revealed something to me, then I start thinking in formal terms about how to exit the poem. And so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was a question up here.
Thank you so much. First, it is amazing and so wonderful to see the two of you up there. So proud of you. And it's such an amazing experience to be so excited for this conversation. So I only wish my daughters were here. I recently made a trip to Auburn, New York, and stood at the graveside of Harriet Tubman Davis.
Yeah.
And I wonder, in this experience that we're talking about out loud, visiting places where the dirt, the red dirt is, and the land is, where our ancestors have bled, and the assertion that we have this sense of urgency to get out, to just get away from here, how that's so, it's juxtaposed to the need and the desire to be there and to be bear witness to the experience. Mm-hmm. I wonder how in the process of writing about that, as you shared so vulnerably, thank you, that in some other time, will it come together in a more cohesive way that we get to speak to the importance of it, and you know, we know there's tours. In fact, I was with a group, and it felt so odd that I wanted to stay and be in the feeling a little bit longer and more, and it was so artificial at the same time. Like, okay, and time to go. So I wonder if you could speak to that, and I know that you both touched on it, but in the future, you know, what does that look like if that space was to be developed, if it were to be turned into an amusement park one day? Do we reclaim these places? Is it relative? Is it an important thing to do?
Right.
As we speak to reparations and taking back land? Mm-hmm. Is that the place to start?
That's a really interesting question. I think we should consider all potential ways of reparation. So I like that idea of like, let's just live in these mansions. You know what I mean? If they're going to, we might as well. They already destroyed like where we actually lived. So, you know, might as well enter the big house. I really like that idea.
I feel like I don't like the idea of an amusement park, period. But in a sacred place. But I do like the idea that we can enter spaces differently. Mm-hmm. You know, ritual is, you know, I think a really great container for that. But it becomes a ritual if you let something go and take something on in stepping into a place. And I think that different postures of observation and acknowledgement are modes of ritual, different ways of saying, I am here and you are here. We stand on opposite sides, it would seem, of this history, but we're doing something here together. I feel like that would be such a wonderful way of marking and then asking these sites that still have life force to be active and to act upon us in a way. And I think it's happening in some places. There are a number of plantations that have changed their public history in response to, you know, descendant communities and the living history that they hold and are eager to impart. It happens in ways that are outside of legislation. It happens in ways that are the result of struggle. You know, it the way those boards have, you know, the form, and then someone's been, it's been overturned, and then they've realized, oh, actually it was correct to think in this other way. It's a process. We have to become comfortable with processes, I think, as a country. We like things to kind of just get snapped into place, but that's not really, you know, how things really positively change. So I love the idea that these landmarks or like, I don't know, it almost feels like they're energy portals.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Can play a larger role in our culture. But it has to be stewarded properly.
Yeah, I love thinking about it as an energy portal. I was just thinking about crystals and charging them and like recharging them. And I think that's a similar idea of like, how do we recharge the space in like a different voltage, you know? But we're not, that's not something that's unfamiliar to us. We do that all the time. Just tear something down and build something else. And we're used to that in a lot of other ways, but not necessarily with our biggest shames, you know?
Yeah, and our is, as a pronoun, is really important because it is our history. No matter who you are or who you believe yourself to be, you descend from this history if you are here, if you claim this nation. And I don't think we've really, like, I don't know if that message has has landed. That's, you know, something that I think, I don't know, it's a campaign that I think could be lovingly waged. This is your history. You don't have to cringe. There are things that you have benefited from, perhaps, that we can talk about.
And you're still navigating it, P.S.
Yeah,
you know,
like, it's not over.
Yeah, and it might help for you to notice how much is rooted from there. You know, you might feel a little bit more less confused, or, you know, but I think there's a lot of, we're very confused about why things are the way they are.
Yeah,
if we're not looking backwards.
And we're very confused about what inheritance is. Just to imagine, I think that the guilty American imagination says, this is rough, but like, white people got lots of stuff. Black people got nothing. I don't want to deal with redistributing that. But that's actually false.
Yeah.
There is a massive inheritance in Black life that's vitally necessary. This is what part of the subtitle of this book is arguing for: the survival and the repair of a nation that seems to be teetering, mm-hmm. let's say. And they're not market-based, you know, yields, but they have everything to do with vision, hope, mm-hmm. Humility, courage. And if you want to go to the direction of the vocabulary of the soul, it's mm-hmm. there too.
Yeah, and spirit.
Mm-hmm. And so these are tools that are in need.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of us are really eager to share them.
Yeah. Other questions?
Last question for tonight.
I'm honored. I hope it'll be good. I was really struck and resonating with some of what you were saying about the hardened language, the repeatable language that doesn't quite make space for nuance, and then also the urgency of like, oh, when will we run out of water? And how I'm wondering how you think about your work, poetry at large, but then also your specific work in conversation with both of those things, in the political moment that we find ourselves in on a week-to-week basis, and then the broader context of like history that we find ourselves in now.
I remember when I was in my first poetry workshops as an undergraduate, my teacher would say, you, meaning all of us, the sooner you become less and less afraid of more and more, then your poems are gonna start going somewhere. And you know what she meant was young poets like hide things, encode things. Mm. You want to give some things away, but you want to keep most of it secret. And the lesson is really to learn a kind of fearlessness. And that's analogous to how I'm thinking toward the answer of that question. You have to learn quickly to be unafraid, so that you can start learning better things, you know, and getting traction. And I feel like the urgencies that we live with, maybe the first thing we can do toward meeting them is to be less afraid about being vulnerable. And then maybe with that as an ethos, we can get into those really complicated nuances where you actually mm-hmm. have to tease things out and listen. So that seems to be two different time frames that we can operate on with a few initial steps. What do you think?
Well, I was thinking while you were talking about this this line where you say that the poetic voice is like stalling, well, figuring out the poetic voice is stalling instead of figuring out the self. And I think it's similar to that, right? Like, instead of finding the right language, let's find the language that sounds best. And similar to, you know, writing. And when I teach poems, I'm like, what are you hiding? You know, like, I see that you put something cute there. That means that the line before it said the truth, you know? And I think that's really how we project our opinions. It's easier to be like, here, I said this in a rhyme. My favorite poems are just the ones that are like, let me just tell you what it is. You know, it's a three-word sentence and it is a command, you know? And that has the urgency also, right? But it's a way of taking out the gentleness or like the palpability, I guess. So I do think there's something there about how being inclined toward poetry and its brevity, it can be like a powerful political, you know, ideology. I think so much of what we get from politics and media and you know, figureheads of all kinds is a lot of like, lots of words that don't mean that many things. And poetry is the opposite of that. It's like few words that means everything. And I feel comforted by that. And I think about that a lot when I'm hearing these speeches where I'm like, what is being said? There are so many words. I'm like looking at it like a student's poem, like what are you hiding in there? I think it is an important way to walk through the world thinking about, okay, how can I like cut through the fat of this, you know, and see what's actually there.
Get ready.
I know, no fucking around. It's a pretty short nonfiction book. It's just straight away. Thank you so much, Tracy.
Oh,
this was
you.
Such a treat. Congratulations.
Oh,
this beautiful,
you.
Beautiful book. I can't wait to read it again. Poets write the best prose.
Aloud is made possible by Hearst Foundations, Golden Globes Foundation, LA County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox Schiff, the Steve and Judith Krantz Foundation, Estate of Suzanne E. Aaron, and individual Library Foundation donors and members. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library. To support programs like these, become a member at lfla.org.